bearing in mind what he's told me you've already gotten. So in the intellectual who am I identity sense, I'm not a physicist, I'm not a nuclear guy, I'm not an academic, I'm not a teacher in a sense of the qualifications. I am an intelligence officer, specifically a CIA operations officer. So much so that at some point in my career, late in my career, I was picked along with four other people. We considered this somewhat of a privilege of sorts to go through the psychological battery that we had gone through as part of our pre-employment interviews to see what we were really like behaviorally, psychologically, to typecast, you know, hiring in some form because we were deemed successful in the career. And that was kind of one of those achievements you don't put on your resume. But I made one condition. I said, now, to all the shrinks, of course, who do this. I said, you guys come back and tell me who I am. Oh, yeah. Of course, they never did. Yeah, so that's just like my old file. I've never seen my own file. And so the first thing came to mind when she said, yeah. And so have the Russians, because when I served in Moscow, I was meeting regularly with the chief of now called the FSB, the Federal Security Service in Russia. It's their counterintelligence service, basically the guys that Putin comes from. And I was meeting regularly with all through the years right after the 1991 coup. And we were sitting having dinner in Moscow one day. He goes, I got a deal for you, Bob. I'll give you your file if you give me my file. I said, I got a better deal for you. How about if I'll never give you your file, and you never give us my file. Ah, that's better. So, but just very shortly, briefly, when I went to West Point, I was considering a whole number of places, and I think that might have been a more pivotal decision in my life, actually, than going into the CIA, because I was thinking Ivy League colleges or West Point was basically where it boiled down, and I'm thinking, ah, could I really be a different person if I went a different route? I don't know the answer to that question. But I don't think West Point, I still believe this today, in any way fulfilled some sort of stereotype of the way people think and what it does to you developmentally. In fact, I went there partially to get what I thought might be a Renaissance man's education. I don't think it disappointed me there, although I was very distracted, like your whole cadets are. Not sure I took full advantage of it. But I went in with a tremendous love of philosophy that's still my greatest intellectual love now. Left in 76 and now, to say, 34 years later, still the thing I like to read the most, and along with what I call the new philosophies and things like theoretical physics and things like that. But anyway, and you'll hear some of that today. So you're going to hear a philosophical bent in what I'm going to offer, and I will talk about things like the nature of modern warfare and conflict and generalize a bit, not in the sense of accepted IR theory, but from the sense of a practitioner talking about what I've experienced and generalizing from a number of the anecdotes I hope to talk about. And the second thing and last thing I'll talk about myself is that I am very much a doer. And I think the transition from the military to the agency was motivated by, one might say, superficial desire, but it's been a strong attraction for me my whole life, just to experience life, just to go out there and mix it up. You can do that as in academia, meeting great students and talking about wonderful topics. You can certainly do it in a whole lot of work. But I never made a calculation of my career or what I wanted to do on the basis of something that was, I would call, a career ambition or moving ahead or getting to a position of higher authority. I don't say that, again, I hope, with any tinge of pride as much as it's got something to leave you with. I think the happiest people are the people who do things to be happy and to enjoy what they're doing to the extent you can do it. Now, that's maybe whatever liberal will go up there. I'll leave it with that. All right, so let me now translate that to a very unhappy subject in a way. And if
can
I
you
look
just
at,
spend a few more minutes on progression, where you've been?
Okay, yeah, sure.
That's important.
Sure. Yeah, so I was in went to West Point during Vietnam, left the military after in 1982, transferred directly over to CIA. Joined as a covert operative, ended up doing 23 years in the CIA, six tours overseas, including, my goal, by the way, as a CIA officer, was to never come back to Washington, serve in what I call to be the the Washington bureaucracy. I enjoyed, again, the overseas part. Almost succeeded. I'll get into that a bit in the story sense here. And then when I retired from CIA in 2005, I had been head of military support, deputy head of military support for the agency. I had been head of the Europe division, which is one of the big traditional power things. I had been chief of weapons of mass destruction for the counterterrorist center. And I had done a number of events, what they call a station chief, which is CIA's most senior officer in several countries, including Switzerland, Norway, Russia, and Yerevan. Not in that order, but those are places I was chief. And also served in Athens, Stockholm, and then traveled all over the world.
Where was Yerevan?
Crimea.
Very interesting time, by the way. I'm happy to talk about any of that in Q&A, too. Some things like, well, the breakup of the Soviet Union and going out and starting embassies and stations in the former Soviet Union in 1991-92 was an amazing experience. And then went to the Department of Energy, and that's really by way of, introducing this topic too. I had become so fixated, and you're definitely going to see my passion for this topic, I hope, with the prospect of terrorists acquiring weapons of mass destruction, that I was asked, and reluctantly accepted because I really wanted to retire and take a break. To join the Department of Energy as the head of intelligence and counterintelligence, which I stayed there for 3 years, from 2005 to the end of 2008. When President Obama was elected, I saw my opportunity to scoot out. Again, I greatly thought it was a wonderful job, wonderful people, but I was just past crispy, you know, in terms of tired, needed a break. And I had gotten to know Dr. Graham Allison from Harvard at that point, who runs the Belfer Center at the Kennedy School. And when he heard I was leaving, he asked me if I'd come here. And I've been here since January 2009 and doing things like this, which I find tremendously gratifying.
Excellent. So, Logan, I think you got somebody in front of you.
Well, anyway, so to this first slide, what I'll try to do here in short and as a basis, at least to center a lot of the questions, is talk about the nature of the problem, describe the problem. It's going to be, again, as a non-scientific description, but what really are we up against when we talk about WMD terrorism? And second, some ideas of what we need to do about it. Big ideas, not so much the tactics. And I want to stress I'm not talking just about nuclear terrorism, but as terrorists see it, is weapons of mass destruction not a particular, what we would call military terms, type of weapon that's pursued as a military type program. Next slide, please.
Yes.
And I do want to start, in fact, with a sense that what we're dealing with is historical. It's not, and one of the things I stress the most is, with all the hyperbole and assumptions that are made about something we still don't understand that well, the biggest one is that this is somehow a function of 9/11, per se, and that once we get beyond, say, what we're describing today as an Al-Qaeda problem, Islamist militants, we're going to get out of this and it's going to go away as just an episode. No, this is going to be with us throughout the century. This is going to greatly impact on your generation and your lives. And one reason I welcome the opportunity to go to academia now is I feel the most important thing I can do at this point is impart some of this knowledge to future generations, future leaders. And I can't stress, I hope that you'll get some sense of that. Don't take my word for it. Challenge me on this. Try to understand it. But I wanted to start with sort of a thing I wanted to leave you with here. And I want to start with my own anecdote to illustrate where I began to believe that this, and it was right at the outset. I was at 9/11, an old CIA Cold Warrior, which should have been evident. I had already done two tours in Moscow, including the Soviet times. I was in charge of liaison with Russian intelligence after the fall of the Soviet Union. My mind was fixated on what we call strategic enemies, strategic adversaries, Russia, China. So I had been a year on the Director Tenet's staff before 9/11. And asked for, you know, he asked me what I wanted to do. I said, I want to go out and be our senior rep station chief in Beijing. I was like, that was my big dream as far as, you know, baseball analogies here. You know, in the record books, being CIA chief in Moscow, there was only one other person in the history of CIA who had done that. And I really wanted to do that. And spent 10 years, if I could, in Asia. Learned Chinese for 2 years with my wife. Great thing. So that's literally what I was doing when the buildings fell on 9/11. In fact, we were taking a break language training, turned on the TV, saw the first plane hit, World Trade Center, saw the second plane hit. I thought it was some sort of really bad advertising thing. I mean, I really was totally confused. even though I've been for a year on the staff watching every day the drumbeat of anticipation that we're going to get hit, I can tell you nobody in the CIA or the White House could fathom what they actually did to make good on the threats that were happening to us. So I, of course, waited for the call. About 2 weeks later, I got the call. It said, George Tenet wants to see you. I went back to Langley. That's headquarters of the CIA. He saw me and said, we've got a very, very big problem involved. Terrorists are trying to get their hands on nuclear weapons, and I'm going to put you in charge of preventing this from happening. And I had no idea. Never done anything like that. My first thought was, why me? And not so much that I was being humble as I knew. I said, what gave me any qualifications for this? And this sounded like the ultimate can't possibly succeed type thing. I said, I worry about that professionally. This was just a big concern if the country was truly in this shape. Well, the reason I set you up with that story is to illustrate a couple of what I didn't, they were, that was what everybody was doing. We were taking cold warriors that were doing other things and pushing into this new war, this new conflict. Whether you want to call it a war or conflict, I'll fudge on that. That might be a good Q&A. Topic to talk about as well. What are we really dealing with here? Is it a conflict? Is it a war? Is it a grievance, a struggle? But at that moment in time, it was definitely a war. There was absolutely no doubt about it. In anybody's mind, nobody would have had this discussion we're having in 2010. And the first thing I had to figure out was, where were we? So I went and read the U.S. intelligence community's best assessments on terrorist weapons of mass destruction. And the bottom line of the assessment was, terrorists can't do anything significant with nuclear biological weapons. That's why I wanted to say this story. And we were absolutely wrong. They had no intent. There was no intelligence. Everything you read about was interesting stuff, by the way. It was talking about how terrorists love to poison one another with weapons like ricin and cyanide. These are what they call crude tactical type chemical and biological agents that can be used as assassination weapons or to kill small numbers of people. Nobody had contemplated the possibility bin Laden was trying to obtain nuclear weapons. Next slide, please. So to try to get a grounding on how far we were behind, and I tell you the truth, my anticipation was we'd go at this for a while and we would find out there wasn't much to it. Met in the White House within the next couple of weeks with the President and Vice President, and I'll just give you the bare bones here. Bottom line was, the Vice President said, can we be sure that Pakistani scientists, this was the problem of the day, haven't helped bin Laden get a bomb? And the answer was, no, we aren't sure. At that point, he said to the director, there were only four of us in the White House at that time of that meeting, go over there, talk to President Musharraf, President of Pakistan, make sure that it hasn't happened. Bottom line, we did. That's from the famous phrase in a lot of books, where President Musharraf's first, I was with George Tenet, we were briefing President Musharraf, there were him and the two of us and one other person in the room, four people in the room, and he heard the briefing, and the Pakistani president said, men in cave can't do this. And so we call that the skeptic's cave today. It's the headline, and I'll say on President Musharraf's behalf, he completely changed his perspective over the next year of working with us on this problem, as did most of his most senior people. But it is, in fact, still a really, really salient question. Can men in caves do something that only, I hate to say it, the United States has done in anger? It is a weapon, which is drop it in another city and destroy or kill hundreds of thousands of people. And there is this impression that they can, and it persists to this day. The other thing I heard that meeting was President Cheney, or Vice President Cheney, famously said, if there's a 1% chance that terrorists, this is in Ron Susskind's book, The 1% Doctrine, it's interpretation. I was there, so I know what was said. I don't think it's exactly the way Mr. Susskind had it, but the essence of Cheney's point was, if we are not prepared for this, CIA is not prepared to deal with this, the director nodded, FBI is not prepared to deal with this, there is no Homeland Security Department. If we're going to treat this as a certainty on speculation, if there's a 1% chance terrorists can get a nuke and drop it on in this city. That's the essence of why that phrase was coined. And it set up this discussion of, and now for the rest of this short presentation, I want you to concentrate on this equation. You've probably heard it, said it many times. Risk equals intent times intent, capability times consequences. And what I'm going to talk about is a little bit about intent, capability, and consequences of what we subsequently discovered and how to think about you answering that question to your satisfaction not people telling you it is or it isn't a threat, but what are the ingredients that go into? I think you know simple math. I'm not a very great mathematician, but I do know that if any of those numbers are zero, the risk is zero. So you have to have some probability of intent and capability. And I don't think we have to argue too much about the consequences about a bomb or a biological weapon killing 100,000 people. It kind of speaks for itself. But I want to talk about a little bit beyond just what we'd say casualties. Next, please. So what is it that the myths have been there? That's essentially what they are. We've already gone through that. I just want you to focus on that as we go on. Is that still a great argument today? And don't be shy if you are skeptical. I won't put you on the spot now. Maybe in Q&A, ask how many of you believe terrorists can detonate a nuclear device. Or it's an interesting, if people are really getting into it, it's about usually about less than 50% of what audience think that a nuclear attack by terrorists is even possible. So it's a very interesting point. And then what are the reasons for that? What's the reason for the skepticism? I'll just list them very quickly.